Classics, the Serial Library, on the web at www.ccel.org. The Tyndale Series of Great Biographies, The Journal of John Wesley, with an introduction by Hugh Price Hughes, M.A., Appreciation of the Journal by Augustine Birrell, K.C., edited by Percy Livingstone Parker, Chicago, Moody Press, 1951. Editor's Note: when John Wesley prepared his journal for publication, he prefaced it with the following account of its origin. It was in pursuance of an advice given by Bishop Taylor in his Rules for Holy Living and Dying that about 15 years ago I began to take a more exact account than I had done before of the manner wherein I spent my time, writing down how I had employed every hour. This I continued to do wherever I was till the time of my leaving England for Georgia. The variety of scenes which I then passed through induced me to transcribe from time to time the more material parts of my diary, adding here and there such little reflections as occurred to my mind. Of this journal, thus occasionally compiled, the following is a short extract. It is not being my design to relate all those particulars which I wrote for my own use only, and which would answer no valuable end to others, however important they were to me. Reverend John Telford, one of Wesley's biographers, says that the earliest parts of the journal were published in the interest of Methodism, that the calumny and slander then rife might be silenced by a plain narrative of the facts as to its founding and its purpose. The complete journals, still preserved in 26 bound volumes, have never been printed. Copious extracts were made by Wesley himself and issued in 21 parts, the successive installments being eagerly expected by a host of readers. The published journal makes 4 volumes, each about the size of the present book. But though I've had to curtail it by 3/4, I have tried to retain the atmosphere of tremendous activity, which is one of its most remarkable features. Mr. Birrell, in his Appreciation, has focused in a very striking way the interest, actuality, and charm of Wesley's journal, and all I have had to do was to select those portions which best illustrate them. The wonder is that it has not been done before. Edward Fitzgerald once wrote to Professor Norton, "Had I any interest with publishers, I would get them to reprint parts of it," for he was a great lover of the journal. Writing to another friend about Wesley's journal, Fitzgerald said, "If you don't know it, do know it. It is curious to think of this diary running coevally with Walpole's letters, diary, the two men born and dying too within a few miles of one another, and with such different lives to record. And it is remarkable to read pure, unaffected, undying English, while Addison and Johnson are tainted with a style which all the world imitated." Macaulay's estimate of Wesley may also be recalled. Wesley, he said, was a man whose eloquence and logical acuteness might have made him eminent in literature, whose genius for government was not inferior to that of Richelieu, and who, whatever his errors may have been, devoted all his powers in defiance of obloquy and derision to what he sincerely considered as the highest good of his species. Wesley is one of the most strenuous ethical figures in history, and literature has no other such record of personal endeavor as that contained in these pages. To make that record accessible to everyone is the object of this edition. Introduction by the Reverend Hugh Price Hughes, M.A. He who desires to understand the real history of the English people during the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries should read most carefully 3 books: George Fox's Journal, John Wesley's Journal, and John Henry Newman's Apologia Pro Vita Sua. As Lord Hugh Cecil has recently said in a memorable speech, The religious question cannot be ignored. It is the question. In the deepest sense, it is the only question. It has always determined the course of history everywhere. In all ages, the skeptical literary classes try to ignore it, as the Roman historians, poets, and philosophers ignored Christianity until the time when Christianity became triumphant and dominant throughout the Roman Empire. But however much ignored or boycotted by literary men, the growth or decline of religion ultimately settles everything. Has not Carlyle said that George Fox making his own clothes is the most remarkable event in our history? George Fox was the very incarnation of that individualism which has played and will yet play so great a part in the making of modern England. If you want to understand the dissidence of dissent and the Protestantism of the Protestant religion, read the journal of George Fox. Then came John Wesley and his helpers. They were the first preachers since the days of the Franciscan friars in the Middle Ages who ever reached the working class. In England, as in France, Germany, and everywhere else, the Reformation was essentially a middle-class movement. It never captured either the upper classes or the working classes. That explains its limitations. As Dr. Rigg has shown, Wesley's itineraries were deliberately planned to bring him into direct contact neither with the aristocracy nor with the dependent or poverty-stricken poor, but with the industrious, self-supporting workmen in town and country. The ultimate result was that the man in the street became Methodist in his conception of Christianity, whatever his personal conduct and character might be. A profound French critic said 50 years ago that modern England was Methodist, and the remark applies equally to the United States and to our colonies. The doctrines of the evangelical revival permeated the English-speaking world. Then Newman appeared on the scene and a tremendous change began. The Anglican Church revived, and revived in Newman's direction. We witness today on every side the vast results of the Newman era. Many of these results are beneficial in the extreme. Others cannot be welcome to those who belong to the schools of George Fox and John Wesley. The whole future of the British Empire depends upon this question of questions. Will George Fox and John Wesley on the one hand, or John Henry Newman on the other, ultimately prevail? And the best way to arrive at the true inwardness of the issue is to read, ponder, and inwardly digest Wesley's journal and Newman's Apologia. It is a great advantage that Mr. Parker has secured permission to republish Mr. Augustine Burroughs' Appreciation. That brilliant writer demonstrates that there is no book in existence that gives you so exact and vivid a description of the 18th century in England as Wesley's journal. It is an incalculably more varied and complete account of the condition of the people of England than Boswell's Johnston. As Mr. Beryl says, Wesley was himself the greatest force of the 18th century in England. No man lived nearer the center than John Wesley. Neither Clive nor Pitt, neither Mansfield nor Johnson. No single figure influenced so many minds, no single voice touched so many hearts. No other man did such a life's work for England. Wesley has demonstrated that a true prophet of God has more influence than all the politicians and soldiers and millionaires put together. He is the incalculable and unexpected element that is always putting all the devices of the clever to naught. I do not understand what Mr. Beryl means by saying that, as a writer, Wesley has not achieved distinction. He was no Athanasius, no Augustine. He was ever a preacher. It is true that Wesley's main business was not to define metaphysical theology, but to cultivate friendly relations with Christians of all schools, and to save living men from sin. But he gave a death blow to the destructive dogma of limited salvation, with which the names of Augustine and Calvin will be forever associated. No doubt, like Oliver Cromwell, Wesley was essentially a man of action, and he deliberately sacrificed the niceties of literary taste to the greater task of making Englishmen on both sides of the Atlantic real Christians. Even so, the style of some of his more literary productions is a model of lucidity and grace. But my main point here is to echo Mr. Burrell's final statement, that we can learn better from Wesley's journal than from anywhere else what manner of man Wesley was, and the character of the times during which he lived and moved and had his being. My co-religionists and all who love the most characteristic qualities of modern English life are under a deep debt of obligation to my friend Mr. Parker and his publishers for giving them an opportunity of studying the eventful 18th century of English history at its center and fountainhead. The fact that this edition of the work has been condensed is no drawback. The journal as originally published was itself condensed by Wesley. For popular purposes, Mr. Parker's edition will answer all important ends and will give English readers for the first time an opportunity of reading in a handy form one of the most important, instructive, and entertaining books ever published in the English language. Of course, Mr. Parker alone is responsible for the selection of the portions of the journal which appear in this volume. Hugh Price Hughes. An Appreciation of John Wesley's Journal by Augustine Birrell, King's Counsel. John Wesley, born as he was in 1703 and dying as he did in 1791, covers as nearly as mortal man may the whole of the 18th century, of which he was one of the most typical and certainly the most strenuous figures. He began his published journal on October 14, 1735, and its last entry is under date Sunday, October 24, 1790, when in the morning he explained to a numerous congregation in Spitalfields Church the whole armor of God, and in the afternoon enforced to a still larger audience in St. Paul's Shadwell the great truth, "One thing is needful," the last words of the journal being, "I hope many even then resolved to choose the better part." Between those two Octobers there lies the most amazing record of human exertion ever penned or endured. I do not know whether I am likely to have among my readers anyone who has ever contested an English or Scottish county in a parliamentary election since household suffrage. If I have, that tired soul will know how severe is the strain of its 3 weeks, and how impossible it seemed at the end of the first week that you should be able to keep it going for another fortnight, and how when the last night arrived you felt that, had the strife been accidentally prolonged another 7 days, you must have perished by the wayside, contesting the three kingdoms. Well, John Wesley contested the three kingdoms in the cause of Christ during a campaign which lasted 40 years. He did it for the most part on horseback. He paid more turnpikes than any man who ever bestrode a beast. 8,000 miles was his annual record for many a long year, during each of which he seldom preached less frequently than 1,000 times. Had he but preserved his scores at all the inns where he lodged, they would have made by themselves a history of prices. And throughout it all he never knew what depression of spirits meant, though he had much to try him, suits in chancery and a jealous wife. In the course of this unparalleled contest, Wesley visited again and again the most out-of-the-way districts, the remotest corners of England, places which today lie far removed even from the searcher after the picturesque. Today, when the map of England was like a gridiron of railways, none but the sturdiest of pedestrians, the most determined of cyclists, can retrace the steps of Wesley and his horse, and stand by the rocks and the natural amphitheaters in Cornwall and Northumberland, in Lancashire and Berkshire, where he preached his gospel to the heathen. Reverend John Wesley, grandfather of John Wesley. Reverend Samuel Wesley, father of John Wesley. exertion so prolonged, enthusiasm so sustained, argues a remarkable man, while the organization he created, the system he founded, the view of life he promulgated, is still a great fact among us. No other name than Wesley's lies embalmed as his does, yet he is not a popular figure. Our standard historians have dismissed him curtly. The fact is, Wesley put your ordinary historian out of conceit with himself. How much easier to weave into your page the gossip of Horace Walpole, to enliven with a heartless jest of George Selwyn's, to make it blush with sad stories of the extravagance of Fox, to embroider it with the rhetoric of Burke, to humanize it with the talk of Johnson, to discuss the rise and fall of administrations, the growth and decay of the Constitution, than to follow John Wesley into the streets of Bristol, or on to the bleak moors near Burslem, where he met, face to face in all their violence, all their ignorance, and all their generosity, the living men, women, and children who made up the nation. A book of plots, plays, and novels. It has perhaps also to be admitted that to found great organizations is to build your tomb. A splendid tomb it may be, a veritable sarcophagus, but nonetheless a tomb. John Wesley's chapels lie a little heavily on John Wesley. Even so do the glories of Rome make us forgetful of the grave in Syria. It has been said that Wesley's character lacks charm, that mighty antiseptic. It is not easy to define charm, which is not a catalog of qualities, but a mixture. Let no one deny charm to Wesley who has not read his journal. Southey's Life is a dull, almost a stupid book, which happily there is no need to read. Read the journal, which is a book full of plots and plays and novels, which quivers with life and is crammed full of character. Wesley's family stock. John Wesley came of a stock which had been much harassed and put about by our unhappy religious difficulties. Politics, business, and religion are the three things Englishmen are said to worry themselves about. The Wesleys early took up with religion. John Wesley's great-grandfather and grandfather were both ejected from their livings in 1662, and the grandfather was so bullied and oppressed by the Five Mile Act that he early gave up the ghost, whereupon his remains were refused what is called Christian burial, though a holier and more primitive man never drew breath. This poor, persecuted spirit left two sons according to the flesh, Matthew and Samuel, and Samuel it was who in his turn became the father of John and Charles Wesley. Samuel Wesley, though minded to share the lot, hard though the lot was, of his progenitors, had the moderation of mind, the Christian conservatism which ever marked the family, and being sent to a dissenting college, became disgusted with the ferocity and bigotry he happened there to encounter. Those were the days of the Calf's Head Club and feastings on the 29th of January, graceless meals for which Samuel Wesley had no stomach. His turn was for the things that are quiet, wise, and good. He departed from the dissenting seminary and in 1685 entered himself as a Force Scholar at Exeter College, Oxford. He bought 2 farthings 6 pence with him, and as for prospects, he had none. Exeter received him. During the 18th century, our two universities, famous despite their faults, were always open to the poor scholar who was ready to subscribe, not to boat clubs or cricket clubs, but to the 39 articles.